Hi, everybody. Aaron Noonan here. Welcome to the V8 Sleuth podcast powered by Timken, a world leader in engineered bearings and mechanical power transmission products and services. Thank you so much for all of your feedback to our last episode. The 2-litre Super Touring Focus episode had a really good response. Thanks, everyone who got in touch. We'll do another one of those down the track on another category. If you like the podcast, that's cool. Make sure you subscribe wherever you listen to your favourite podcast. So you don't miss an episode. You can listen to it as well through our v8sleuth.com.au website. Tell all your mates, leave a review. We love your feedback, good, bad, or indifferent. We'll cop it all. We'll probably ignore the bad bits, but we'll take the good bits, that's for sure. And also, we've had amazing response to our new book, Racing the Lion, our 400-page collector's edition. It's the Holden Illustrated Australian Motorsport History Book that features a wide range of amazing Holden imagery. Perfect gift for Christmas, by the way, if you want to get in nice and early and lock that one away now. Jump on our website, bookshop.v8sleuth.com.au. You'll find other book titles as well, a range of motorsport DVDs and posters and prints too. Now, a guy who features prominently in our Racing the Lion Holden book because he is a prominent man in Holden and its motorsport history is my guest on the podcast this week, Greg Murphy. Now, the four-time Bathurst 1000 winner is synonymous with the general, but he's done a pile of cool stuff in his motor racing career away from the supercar stuff. And I guess in this podcast, we spent a fair bit of time talking about the non-Commodore supercar things purely because no one stopped to ask him for so many years. So on part one of the podcast, I talked to Greg about Formula Brabham open wheelers and super touring and how his relationship began with Boost Mobile's Peter Adderton. We talk about the 1996 New Zealand Mobile Sprints that he won in the Holden Racing Team Commodore that sent him on a whole new level of awareness in his homeland. Holden fans, block your ears. We talk about the time that Murph drove the peanut slab Ford Sierra. Holden fans, unblock your ears. You didn't hear what just happened. We also talk about the, well, interesting test with the Williams British Touring Car Championship Renault Laguna team that didn't quite go anywhere. We also talk about the Bathurst that Murph did with Triple Eight in a Holden, and also his brief run tackling NASCAR racing. Stay tuned for part two as well. We talk about the Spider-Man Kmart Commodore, the famous 2004 Gold Coast press conference with Marcus Ambrose, winning the 24-hour Bathurst race in the Monaro with Brocky and Todd Kelly and Jason Bright. In the National Motor Racing Museum Couch Racer Questions, there are plenty relating to Bathurst 2005, and we get from Murph whether that car that was in that incident with Marcus Ambrose was in fact drivable back to the pit lane. We also cover off the Motor Focus Top 10 Shootout, our fancy form of word association, and Murph, well, he's topped a shootout or two in his time. He handled it pretty well. Now, I chatted to him from home over a Zoom call in recent weeks. So here we go. Buckle up. Time to start part one of Greg Murphy on the V8 Sleuth podcast, powered by Timken.
Well, our listeners have asked, we have answered, and Greg Murphy's answered our Zoom call in New Zealand. Welcome to the V8 Sleuth podcast. It has taken us until episode 509,042 and 48 to get you, but we got there.
Jeez. Well, you never asked earlier.
Well, what I wanted to do was leave enough space, Greg, between your other infrequent podcast appearances, including with your neighbour down the road, Mr. G. Rust. I wanted to leave enough space to just not over-murph the listenership of podcasts.
Good. So, I think it's very valid. And if I got rid of the background of the Kmart Commodore at Bathurst, you'd actually see Greg Russ's house over my shoulder. That's true.
I know. A lot of people don't believe it, but he lives, what, stone's throw down the road from you in New Zealand?
Well, I can't throw stones quite that well, but it's not that far. I can actually see his upstairs bedroom window from my front lawn. Yeah,
that's way
terrifying as that may sound.
It's way too early in the podcast to be getting into a bit of that style of stuff. Normally, that takes at least an hour. But hey, thanks for spending some time. Obviously, at the moment while we're recording this, we're locked down in Melbourne. You're in NZ. We haven't had you over here, obviously, for the Supercars Championship since Albert Park because of the borders and planes and travel restrictions and the like. So I guess first question first, how are you traveling? What's happening in your world? Are you keeping yourself nice and busy?
Yeah, it's sort of really weird. I have been quite busy. It's just a different kind of busy because you're trying to sort of fulfill, you know, obligations over here, which are a little bit difficult as well because of the ins and outs of the lockdown. Trying to sort of do a few things that I also wouldn't have had time to do previously and focus on a couple of areas, but a road safety stuff has sort of had a bit more time to do a bit of that as well. And so that's been good. So, you know, it isn't as busy as I'd like it to be for sure, but the days are disappearing quite quickly. It's just not a lot of the day is what I would normally be doing. So, you know, it's incredible to think that we are towards the end of August though already at this point. I am missing not coming to Australia and doing the job and working with the team at Supercars TV and helping produce that broadcast. I have been sitting very weirdly on the couch watching it from home.
I was going to say, this is probably the longest period you've gone without a flight to Australia in what, 20 odd years?
Mate, it's the longest period I have had consecutively at home, without doubt, for the last 20 years. It's quite interesting when you start to think about that, but it is fact because of the schedule, you know, being attached to motorsport in Australia and the Supercars Championship. You know, your schedule is what it is, and you know it, you know, pretty much every October prior to the next season.
Has Monique had you doing jobs around the house and around the property? Is there anything that you've been getting out of for a couple of years that this has caught up with you on that you've had to do?
She's actually sitting over there listening to that question right now.
And
the look that I just got out of the corner of my eye was, I better be careful how I answer this. Now, in hindsight, sitting here letting her listen to this, it was not a good idea. Haven't done as much as what she probably expected I was going to do. Is that a good answer, love? And I just got a,
Not really, not really. shall we move on for your sake more than mine?
Yeah.
Okay, let's do it. Hey, last week on the podcast, Will Dale and I did a special super touring episode because we've had a lot of feedback from the fans who wanted to hear some memories and some thoughts on the era. We watched it. You were a part of it. And the two standout moments for me in two-litre history in Australia, if you could pick two, is the Longhurst and Morris punch-up, which got more PR than just about any other motorsport thing in the 90s. Yeah. But that three-wide fight at Lakeside with you, Brad Jones, Paul Morris.
Jones gets a run down the inside. He's got the inside running for the corner linear on the straight. Morris is going to hang in there.
Oh, look at this as Morris stays with him. And Murphy says, I want a part of this too. Oh, no, 1, 2, 3 abreast as they go down. The kicker can't do this, but they've done it. What about Jones in the centre? What can he do? Murphy's going to win the corner. Oh, that has got to be the hairiest ride I've ever seen down the main straight of Lakeside. 3 abreast through the kick.
It's some of the best vision I've ever seen. I get so excited every time I watch it. Give me your memories on how that unfolded, how it came to be, and how on earth you all made it out the other side.
Well, I think before I go any further, I mean, Darrell Eastlake's commentary, I don't think it would have been the same without it, would it? I mean, it was just that voice over the top of that racing is something that, they go hand in hand for sure. But the super touring thing was pretty exciting at the time, and obviously I was very fortunate enough to have been given a slot with Brad Jones Racing in the Audi, the Oryx Audis, which was due to my mate Peter Addison, and the work he was doing at super touring. He was a part owner in the championship with Terry Morris, and obviously absolutely got fully entrenched in that category. And through his work and efforts and connections, there was, my tenure there at Brad Jones Racing was all part of that. And so I was pretty lucky to get that chance. And so, you know, I was in a bit of a hurry, obviously looking for success and wanting to do big things in Australia. And you know, just, you know, I knew I was the number two in that team, but I didn't really – accept it very well. And I think, you know, I sort of rubbed Braden Kim up the wrong way pretty quickly, pretty early on in the piece. And we've had a few laughs in the past, since then, I suppose, about it all. I don't know if Brad's fully gotten over it, but I think Kim sort of more so has. But it was Lakeside was an interesting space. The Audis worked strangely in places where you wouldn't have thought that they were going to be very good. And then places where you really thought they were going to be great, they didn't tend to be as fast as what we hoped. But Lakeside that weekend, I mean, the battles were huge. The battles between Paul, Jeff Brabham, myself, Brad, and everybody else, they were pretty epic. And the racing was close, very fast and furious. And Lakeside was just one of those places. I mean, far out. I have great memories of driving there and being terrified most of the time as well, because there was no runoff anywhere, but it was just a great racetrack. And that weekend, it was a little bit of a difference. I think Brad had a bit of an upgrade in the old engine front. Obviously the four-wheel drive and the Quattro, and it was, I think there was a bit of a weight penalty that we may have had because of that and bits and pieces, but it was a full-on battle, and he had a little bit of an engine upgrade that I didn't have, and the Beamers were very fast, obviously, and I remember sort of driving the absolute wheels off the thing, trying to keep up with the guys in front. And as it so happened, that race, we'd been sort of banging wheels and all that kind of stuff, and then it got to a point coming down to the onto the front straight there that Brad and Paul ended up getting side by side, and were a bit slow coming onto the front straight. And I just sort of positioned myself and saw an opportunity to get a bit of a run, and I ended up obviously inside against the pit wall, but on the outside going through the kink, turn one. And it was one of those moments. It's like, oh well, we're here now, and you know, I got four-wheel drive, so if I have two wheels off the road, she'll be right. And it just became one of those halo moments for the category, and very, very memorable as far as super touring goes, and it made the papers, and it made the news, and that's what super touring was all about. And I just happened to come out the other side of it on the right side of it for a little while until I was instructed to pull over.
Now, speaking of the relationship with Bradley and Kimmy, tell me about the day, and I think you've talked about this plenty of times, but because it was Brad Jones Racing, not Greg Murphy Racing, the deal was that Brad Jones would finish in front, but there was a day at Malalar in 1996 when you two were smashing them, 1-2, on the way home. He crosses the line and thinks the race is over, but there's one lap to go. So you take the lead and have to virtually jump on the brakes at the end of the race to give him back the win. Yeah. I don't think Bradley knows how to count. I don't think he still does.
Oh, it was pretty funny. I mean, there was a few moments there that I didn't accept or take too well when it came to team orders. But you're right, it did have BJR on the car. They did own the team and they did pay the bills. I think 96 I played the game a little bit better, or was a bit more accepting of it than what I was in 95. But yes, you're right. We came round 1-2 to take the white flag. Unfortunately, BJ thought, I think it was a checkered flag, and backed off and pulled the window net down and started waving to all his fans. And I was like, this is going to be interesting, as I swept on by. And he had to obviously go down a couple of gears to get going again, and subsequently pulled over on coming out of the last corner to let him take his rightful spot there at the front and grab another trophy. He was quite appreciative of that one and a little embarrassed.
I reckon he owed you a trophy out of that one, to be honest. Before you mentioned Peter Adderton, of course, a lot of people who follow the sport now really know him for the Boost Mobile stuff, yep, and sponsoring GRM and James Courtney in recent times. But where did your path with Pete start way back in the day? Of course, the Super Touring stuff evolved. He was involved with you with trying to get you to America, which I want to talk about a bit later. But where did that relationship start? I've never stopped to ask the question or consider it.
Well, it's quite a cool story, actually. And it's one of these ones, it's about being in the right place at the right time. In 94, Kev, my dad, and I had a pretty successful sort of season in New Zealand, and it was time to make a bit of a decision, and the decision was, let's go and do the Australian Drivers' Championship in Australia, or at least do the first round and see what happens. So we'd met Graham Brown and Steve Cramp who had a Rolt RT21, and we did a bit of a deal with them to come to Australia at Sydney Motorsport Park or Eastern Creek back in 94 to do the first round of that championship. And it just so happened that the Australian Drivers' Championship, was supporting the first ever inaugural Australian Super Touring Championship, was their first round. And so we turned up at the event, did our due diligence, did a bit of practice and testing prior to the race meeting, and subsequently, you know, stuck the old Rolt on pole at Eastern Creek and won the two races of the weekend. And we thought that was all pretty cool and great, and we're sort of sitting around on Sunday afternoon going, well, what next? What from here? Because the bank balance at that point was pretty low, and Kev had sort of sold his wares as much as he could to try and raise some cash. And next minute, we're sitting around in the garage there at Eastern Creek, and this bloke walks in and he says, who's the driver? And I'm like, oh, I'm the driver. He goes, oh, g'day, my name's Peter Addison. And who are you? And what's your story? And I sort of gave him a bit of a story, told him about this. And he's like, okay, well, do you want to drive a Super Tour at the next round at Phillip Island in a few weeks? I'm like, blah, 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 blah. How does what? Though? What? Anyway, true to his word, we turned up a few weeks later and found a little bit more money. And he helped out, of course, to get the Formula Holden to Phillip Island. And also turning up there was a Toyota Carina that had been intercepted by Peter on its way to New Zealand for Bruce Miles. Bruce Miles had bought the car off from James Kay, or I think probably Roland Dane, I would say.
Park Lane.
And it was on its way to New Zealand, and Pete intercepted, and we turned up at Phillip Island. All of a sudden, I'm not driving just one car, I'm driving two, a single-seater and a touring car on the same weekend. And that was the start of our relationship. And from that point on, you know, Pete was a big influential, important part of my career in the early days in Australia, and also, as you said, supported me trying to chase my dream in America.
It's one of those things, normally when someone comes into a garage asking, where's the driver, you're probably thinking you're in trouble and you've pissed someone off.
Yeah, of course.
Really wrong, not someone who's going to set up the next X amount of years of your career.
Yeah, that's right, exactly right. And you know, he's flamboyant and you know, very energetic, just a, you know, a very, very intriguing businessman, very smart, clever, and not afraid of going at it. And you know, he's loving the fact that he's now being able to come back and have an involvement in supercars with Boost. And, you know, he's already contributed a lot to that. And obviously, he's had a few rocks thrown at him here and there. But at the end of the day, he's only in it for the right reasons and he loves it. And you know, now James is having that opportunity to give a bit of payback.
He's a bit of a polarizing character, but I love what he brings. Obviously, yes, yep. He spent a lot of money and backed a lot of people and a lot of racing and cars and teams, but he brings something that our sport doesn't normally deal well with, and that's, I think the buzzword is a disruptor, and that's what he is, self-proclaimed in terms of business, but that's what he does in motor racing. And we're so used to everyone saying the right thing, towing the right line, not saying what they think when we all might think certain things, but say them. He's the one who goes and says it. We've all got the bullets in the chamber, but he fires them.
Yeah, yeah. And then gets knocked for it because no one else usually tends to back him up when that happens. But good on him, and it's as I say, I'm very fortunate that he played a part and got involved in motorsport, and he and his brother, Mark Addison, and also Matt, the other brother, but Mark did a lot of racing and super touring too, and was actually a bloody good peddler. Had not as much success as what he deserved because he was actually very fast and very committed behind the wheel of the various cars that he got to drive.
We actually covered a bit of that in the podcast last week. I think he drove the Peugeots, the Toyota Camry, which there wasn't many of those in the world.
Honda.
Ford, yeah, that's right. Volvo, he ended up in the Volvo team there with Jim Richards for a little while,
yep.
Late in the period. So he's he did a fair bit of pedaling. He'd be good to have a chat to on our podcast one day for a lot of people who probably haven't heard or seen him since the 2 litre days. But I think moving from Pete's a bit of a natural segue in, you're one of those guys in the sport that people either love or they loathe. There's no one on the fence about you, and that's one of the things that I think's we can sit here and talk all day about it's not the same anymore and everyone's too nice and all that sort of stuff. But you've always been like that, mate. You've, in the 20 plus years I've worked with you or known you, there's no grey. You're black or white. Where did that come from in you? You've always been a hard on the sleeve guy. Where did that develop? Is that a thing that your dad had? Is that a thing that you developed as a kid? Where does that come from?
I don't really know, mate, to be honest. I wasn't like that as a kid at all. I wasn't much chopping anything else other than karting. So, you know, I wasn't much good at ball sports. It was no good at rugby. That's why I've got this bloody crooked nose, because of rugby. And I was just I was too small to be a forward, and I was too slow to be a back. So I never really found a spot. Didn't have a lot of ball skills in that respect at all, but I found karting, and it was something that did sort of resonate and seemed to go pretty good at. But yeah, I'm not so sure about the short temper, the lack of patience, what that developed, because that's certainly not Kev. It's certainly not my mum. I don't know. I'm not quite sure where it all developed and why it developed, but I was just in a hurry, and I didn't sort of accept mediocrity from myself in any way, shape, or form, and I certainly didn't accept it too much from anyone else. And I suppose I had pretty strong beliefs in what was right and what was wrong. But as you say, it was always black and white. It wasn't grey. Spoke it the way I, you know, believed it should be spoken. But I also knew that I'd worked hard to get where I was. I'd been given opportunities by people, and it was always about paying it back, I suppose, in some ways too, because the expectation was always high, and it was always, you know, the expectation and people believing in you to give you those chances. I always felt that I needed to make sure that I rewarded them with that. Unfortunately, the flip side to it was that I sometimes, you know, wearing that heart on the sleeve, didn't probably direct the right sort of or portray the right kind of appreciative kind of manner in some respects. I always appreciated the opportunities I was given, but I always also felt that, you know, when it didn't go well, I wasn't going to pretend it was all great and wonderful. I was never going to, you know, go smile and say, oh, well, you know, let's look forward to the next one kind of deal. It was like, well, this is the way it is at the moment, and it's not good enough, or, you know, we need to do a better job, I need to do a better job, whatever it was. So I don't know. I don't know where that impatience came from and the lack of sort of acceptance of poor performance.
Has it flowed onto any of your kids, or has it stuck with you?
No, it's pretty much with me, sort of thing. So that's probably a positive in many respects. I've got quite a argumentative middle child. He should be a lawyer probably out of anything, because he tends to argue black and blue regardless of how poor his argument actually is. But the older one, Ronan's, no, doesn't carry my mental genetic makeup, which is good and bad.
It's probably a good thing, actually, all things said. Hey, what along the way where you have told it how it is, or stood up for yourself, or thrown a punch, not literally, but in terms of verbally at someone along the line, did you ever get pulled in a line by a team manager or a team owner or a major sponsor along the line who said, hey, no, mate, we don't want any of that, or you need to curb it? Is there any particular instances that spring to mind?
Yes and no. I mean, looking back and you know, situations that, yeah, you know, weren't as professional as what they should have been from my point of view, from my doing, I should say. You know, I actually wish there had been a bit more ass kicking from some of the management, to, you know, just to remind me sometimes, and also, you know, I suppose make me think a little bit differently about the way I was going about it. And, you know, Jeff Gricks was pretty good. There was moments there where he certainly did, you know, pull me into line and remind me of what was what. And so did John Crennan, which was great. But it probably required sometimes a little bit more of that kind of those actions, you know. And you know, the good days were good, but, you know, the bad days not so good. And as I say, some of that was born by the fact whereas I felt the pressure to be maybe performing better and was hard on myself, which may have come across as being negative towards the team, but it wasn't, because I was in great teams with great people that always delivered, you know, me some you know, the opportunities, good opportunities. It didn't go quite to plan later in the years, and that was frustrating and hard. But you know, I did have some great people around me and awesome teams for a large portion of my career.
One of the things we've been really lucky on this podcast to talk to a lot of Bathurst 1000 winners in the last 12 or so months. And I've asked everyone the one question that, well, we're lucky enough we get to talk to you guys and we deal with you all regularly in our motor racing and media worlds and away from it as well. But I want to ask everybody, how did winning Bathurst, so for you in 96 with Craig Lowndes, when they always say winning Bathurst changes your life, how did winning Bathurst for that first time, forget the subsequent times, they were all good follow-ups, but how did it change your life? Because I've got a little bit of a funny feeling that as big as that was, the bit that gets forgotten by us on this side of the ditch is what happened a month or so later when you took HRT to New Zealand with car number one and you won the two-weekend series at Pukki and Wellington, where that escalated you even higher and harder in your homeland. But just to cover the first part, what did winning Bathurst change in your life then and now?
Yeah, mate, it does change pretty much everything because it gives you recognition that maybe you didn't know, you didn't have, but all of a sudden every media outlet in New Zealand wants to talk to you and wants to give you time and tell your story. You know, everyone over here knows what Bathurst is. I mean, everybody knows in this part of the world, Australia, New Zealand, and pretty much many other parts of the world that follow motorsport, they know what it is, and it's a big deal. I mean, that prize title is something that you know, so many people aspire to. Not many get the chance or get to hold that trophy or have that trophy. So you know, it was massive, and I vividly recall, you know, the phone, you know, lighting up afterwards and people wanting to talk to you and you know, give you that time in the papers, on the television, all that kind of stuff. And also, as you said, you know, I think it definitely then gave me this the chance to be trusted with you know, the car coming over to New Zealand and doing that event as well alongside Brock and doing the mobile series back in 96 then. And then subsequently with Lounsey buggering off overseas, you know, all of a sudden I find myself the factory driver alongside Peter in 1997.
Was it that weekend in New Zealand where you actually did the deal for the next year?
Yeah, it was. It was. Yeah. It was actually Saturday afternoon in the hotel there in Wellington. John Crennan sat me down and we went through a bit of a plan and that's pretty much where it was done. And looking back on it now, it was like, oh my God, he could have said, I'm not gonna pay you, and I probably still would have signed, you know. And I know exactly what the money was back then, and it was not a lot. So I didn't have a manager or anything. I didn't even have time to talk to Kev about it. It was just like. Sign on the dotted line.
I wanted to touch on Wellington because there was such an amazing history of the street race, and it's a nice little segue because there's a new book on the Wellington street race and its history coming out in the next couple of months, which, by the way, in our online bookshop, bookshop.v8sleuth.com.au, there's the plug, you can pre-order it now. And it covers all of the years from 85 to 96 that the street race was run with the Nissan Mobile 500s, the World Touring Car Championship, the 2-litre races that were held, and then ultimately that last event in 96, which by that stage the track had been shortened quite a bit. And because we're on this side of the ditch, we don't see what's happened. But am I right in saying, Murph, that the old track as it was is no longer able to be used because there's been development and building there and a lot of it's gone?
Yeah, that's right. And in 96, it was quite different too to what it was previously. So it was 93 was the last consecutive event, wasn't it? And then there was a gap.
Oh, no, 92 was the last year of the the touring
Yeah, that's right. And then 93 was a bit of a mixed bag kind of event.
Yep.
There was some super tourers there, and there was Porsches and all sorts of different things. And then there was the gap until 96. So the track had changed quite a lot even for 1996, and there was a fair bit of development going on. And then now it's unrecognizable pretty much of what it of its former self with the amount of development that has happened there.
We mentioned that late part of 96 and winning Bathurst. Now, I've got a theory that the young guns who win Bathurst these days don't know how to celebrate it or party. I went to enough of those leagues, club and pub parties on the Sunday night. I've stumbled out of Panthers at 4 a.m. I know exactly the deal in my younger days. And there's the famous photos of you and Lowndes still hungover at the track doing your photo shoot with the winning car the next day. Do you agree that the supercar stars of today cannot party like the supercar stars of the 90s?
Oh, my God. That's going to start open a can of worms, isn't it? I think they probably party in a different way than what we did back then. I think what happens on Sunday night after Bathurst is very, very different to what it used to be. I mean, those days, mate, yes, they were special. I mean, the event and you've got to remember, though, too, that that was the end of the season pretty much. I mean, 96 was a little different because we did ship ourselves off to New Zealand for a couple of race meetings. But, you know, back in the 90s there, when did the championship extend past Bathurst? Was it 90?
It was the last round in 99 when you won, and in 2000.
It was.
Because it was in November still, remember?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And in 01, it went back to October, and then we added Pukekohe and Sandown finale. So yeah, 01, it's been about 20 years since it's
so
been.
So was the end of the season, you know, and so it was just like everyone just unleashed fury and then wasn't worried about Monday morning because the cars didn't need to be rushed back to the workshop to be rebuilt for another event. So yes, it was good times, and the old Bathurst RSL was the go-to venue, and it didn't shut the doors, it didn't close it. Whatever time it closes now or midnight, it pretty much stayed open until the last person managed to slither themselves out the door. So, yeah, and it's a bit of a shame, but the championship has obviously expanded and changed so much. And I think the young boys still know how to have a good time. I think it involves apps on their phones, though, as well, and which we didn't have back in the day.
Probably safer that you didn't. Hey, there's a chance, a red hot chance this year, though, as we record this, things are changing quickly, and by the second, plans can change in the current world. But if Bathurst is the last round this year, the modern era boys might be on it.
That could be it. I mean, there might need to be some special planning, I would imagine, around that to get some sort of deal going. And you know, if it is the last round, I mean, you can sort of see the potential for maybe I doubt there's still going to be plans for a big gala dinner. So maybe it is a decent celebration at the end of it all, and we might see some resurrection of the old days.
Inject a little bit of financials into the Bathurst economy on the Sunday evening. We touched on that New Zealand street race in 96, and I watched the tape again the other day just to refresh my memory on that. And
literally, I think it is a tape. Was it a videotape? Because that's all I've got of it.
Yeah, it was
actual videotape.
It was VHS converted to DVD, converted to digital. So it's been through a couple of evolutions. But I don't think people in Australia understand how big that event was. And I touched on it before, but there was, for those who don't remember, there was a three-race sprint format. There were 12 cars taken across the ditch. As you mentioned, yourself and PB and the HRT cars, two Wayne Gardner cars, two Dick Johnson cars, two Castrol Perkins, Glenn Seaton, Tony Longhurst, and the two Alan Jones cars that had been pack leader, but they were for AJ and Paul Radisich, who was making a bit of a V8 return for the weekend. And then the next weekend was another three at Wellington. So you cleaned them up at Pookie and won all three. And then at Wellington, though, it didn't go as smoothly, and JB ended up winning on points, but you won the last race, won the series, and probably got the main headlines and the plaudits. But just can you explain to the listeners how big that event was for you? How big was it for New Zealand motorsport? It's probably the likes of which we haven't seen since then.
Yeah, just nutso. I mean, in comparison, I suppose, when we came as part of the championship in 2001 for the first time, you know, at Pukekohe, I mean, the crowd there was bigger. We've had bigger crowds at Pukekohe just because of the access to the joint. Bathurst was Bathurst, but to come back to New Zealand, come to that Wellington event and the Pukekohe event as well the week before, which again was just off scale huge as far as people, for 12 cars as well. As you say, it wasn't like it was a full field, but for 12 cars, the crowd that turned out for it was just off scale. It was nuts, completely nuts. You know, the biggest crowd I've ever seen to the point in New Zealand. And then Wellington the following weekend, yeah, they just flooded the joint. They were hanging out of car parking buildings, out of, office buildings, every single vantage point. I mean, you just wouldn't get away with anything like it anymore. I mean, part of where the racetrack was, there's a park in the centre, and which was a ongoing development, and there was no railings or anything. There was just people sitting on this concrete structures and stuff on the edge. They're hanging over the edges. There wasn't even any fencing or anything like that. It was just crazy, and you know it was the shiver down the spine all weekend. But you're right, the Wellington event didn't quite go to plan. I actually stuck the thing in the fence on Saturday. And did a fair bit of damage to the back end of my number one car, and we had to do a bit of a resurrection job, and then qualifying, wasn't so good. I think I qualified sixth, and only made sort of slow progress in the first couple of races, and then the last race, you know, the Bridgestone shod HRT cars were pretty good. Obviously weapons, Lanzi had cleaned up the championship. We'd won the stand down, won Bathurst and then gone to New Zealand. So expectation of the car was pretty good. The other Bridgestone cars, Glenn was clearly pretty quick, and Paul Radisich was on fire that weekend as well. So we had some pretty incredible dices. But you know, it is incredibly memorable because, again, flowing on from the success at Bathurst and getting that recognition as a race car driver and a Kiwi driver to then end up in New Zealand, you know, for those events was just a mega time. And, I had to keep pinching myself that it was actually real.
It's scary to believe that next year's 25 years since that happened here. I think you've got a yapping little friend in the background there.
I've got my yapping dog out there who's driving me a little bit mad at the moment.
What's your dog's name, man? Listeners want to know. We love pooches.
Yeah, right. His name is Spud.
Spud. Oh, original.
Spud Murphy. and that was actually for Larko.
He's the only person I've ever heard call you Spud.
That's right. So Larko calls me Spud. And so when we got this one, he's sort of a light brown colour. So he got termed with that one. So he's a cross between a lab and something. We don't quite know what he is, but he's a rescue dog. And we've had him for about, since, when did we get him? May last year. So whatever that is, 15, 16 months.
Yeah, good. We like our dogs here on the VS Lewis podcast. I have a chocolate Labrador who's dug up my backyard, which is great, in a Melbourne winter under lockdown. So at least we got to watch it.
We'll get back to the podcast in just a moment, but I wanted to quickly tell you about our good friends at Timken, a world leader in engineered bearings and mechanical power transmission products and services. Now, you might know their name and you might recognise their logo, but did you know that Timken bearings are used in the centrepiece of one of the most stunning stadiums in the world of sport? The $2 billion, yes, billion-dollar Mercedes-Benz Stadium in Atlanta features a retractable roof that is a work of incredible engineering. It features 8 triangular roof panels, or pedals as the designers call them, that slide open and close in the same way that a camera shutter does. Each pedal weighs almost 500 metric tons, and when the roof is closed, each pedal cantilevers over 60 metres from the outer edge of the stadium. Now, despite the weight, the size and the complexity of the design, the roof can be closed in just over 7 minutes and open in just over 8. with Timken's tapered roller bearings used to ensure each pedal moves smoothly. The stadium's home to the Atlanta Falcons NFL team and the Atlanta United Major League Soccer team, and in 2019, it hosted the crown jewel of American football, the Super Bowl. We'll bring you more cool facts about Timken in each episode of the V8 Sleuth podcast through the course of the year. Now, it's back to the podcast.
We talk about Wellington. Everyone knows you as a Holden hero. You've driven every round of supercars that you've ever been in a Commodore. But there's a little dirty part of your history that the Holden fans either don't know or choose to forget. Tell me about the Peanut Slab Sierra and driving the Nissan Mobil races, because I'm imagining a Group A Sierra on the streets of Wellington by that stage when they were really far along the line was a bit of a light switch and a bit of a baptism of fire for a young open wheeler kid.
Yes, it was. Mark Pitch was the owner of the slab. And my association sort of came around due to connection through my sponsorship with Shell Oil back in the day. I'd won the scholarship in 1990, and then subsequently from that point on, they'd continued to give me a bit of a helping hand. And we basically, Mark Pitch came to me and said, "Oh, you know, listen, what's your plans moving forward?" And we had a chat about it and all. He said, "Well, you know, we're pretty keen to have you on board for the Nissan Mobil series coming up to drive with Kane Scott heading into the, you know, there was the 1992 series." And I was like, "Oh my goodness gracious." I think what had I driven before that touring car was at the racing school that I was working at at Manfield. Richard Lester had an old Roadways Group A Commodore. Which was a genuine car. And that was, I can't remember who owned it, but it was there and we used to do a few.
Was that one of those, maybe the Sleepyhead car or the Can-Am car or one of those Kiwi Roadways?
Actually, now you mention it could have been the Can-Am car, to be honest, from memory. That's actually stuff that I've brought it up and now I'm trying to remember it all, to be honest. But it was we used to do a bit of school driving with it at Manfield, and I think that was probably the, you know, that was the biggest, wildest sort of touring car that I'd driven, and I hadn't spent a lot of time in it, but anyway, it was a bit of fun. So then, you know, driving a Sierra Cosworth though was a whole different ball game. And I got to drive it in practice at Wellington, the only laps I did was around Manfield running in the engine in the wet. So it was a terrible Manawa 2 day, and I got to do a few laps in the car and then off to Wellington. So that was my preparation. And subsequently, we got there and I mean, it was, an eye-opener, such an eye-opener, because the thing was heavy as all hell, no power steering, five-speed box it was in that one. And they were a little bit like light switches back in the day, and we had to wrangle this thing around the track. But again, just a huge experience, and you know, I just absolutely, you know, couldn't believe that I was there racing on that racetrack against some of the people that were there racing, some of my obviously heroes, and having a crack, and it worked out pretty good. We Kane and I finished fourth at Wellington, and we finished fourth at Pukekohe the next week. I think we ended up second overall for that series that year.
Did you get a bit of time on the track with a certain bloke in 05 and have a little fanboy moment?
Of course, yes. Yes, absolutely. I mean, and the thing is, back then I can remember vividly, you know, Brock was just so Brock, typical Brock, you know, it's just like, have a chat. He's like, treated you like he'd known you for 20 years, and you were like, Peter Brock. It was pretty funny stuff.
There's heaps of V8 chat and PB chat we could have. We could talk all day about it. But when the first lockdown happened in New Zealand earlier in the year, you were sharing a lot of great photos from your career and where you've been over your time in motorsport. And one of the ones that I think is pretty cool that probably
you haven't talked about much because we get so focused on the V8 stuff and the tin top stuff was your pathway to trying to go to the States and do some stuff in Indy cars and Indy lights. And you ended up, you put up a photo not long ago of your Indy car test. I think it was at Putnam Park from memory in the US in 97 when you were at HRT. And there's a bloke who was testing the same day. I think you were there to do Indy lights though, weren't you?
That's right.
They wheeled out an Indy car and said, hey, how about this? So that was a total shock and they didn't send you an invoice for it.
No, so it was a bit of a surprise. So, you know, the project, I think it was called Project Indy, was the name of the team. And they were a bit of a fledgling sort of organisation, you know, trying to, you know, find that that person to come along with the big money and get them going and all that kind of stuff. And they had this Indy Lights car and it wasn't currently being run. And so it is a very long story, so I'm going to try and keep it short. But we ended up, through some of the people that were trying to help me out, we put together this test over there and we went and had 2 days of testing in this car. And it was one of those situations where, you know, I think the team owner of the Indy car sort of was like, okay, it's a money-making opportunity here to get some money for this test and didn't really think much of it. And the car turned up out the track and they also had the Indy car there in the transporter and they were going to be doing some testing. I don't know when. It hadn't actually been run before I did my test or during my test with the Indy Lights car, but they had pulled it out and I think maybe they were going to be doing some testing. But anyway, our Indy Lights test had gone really well and, you know, I'd done a fair few number of laps. And the guy that owned the car had said, hey, you know, if you guys, he'd been watching the times and so it was like, oh, that's, you're going, right? He said, well, you know, and then he was obviously thinking, well, here's an opportunity. Don't really know who these guys are, but if this kid's any good, you know, maybe there's something we can be doing and maybe there's a chance that he could end up in an Indy car. And so what he did was say, if you call quits on the test with the Indy Lights car and save putting more miles on it, you know, you can maybe do a few laps in the Indy car. I was like, well, that doesn't take a lot of thinking about, not a lot of time of thinking. And so we did that. And so I strapped into the Lola and off we went. My bloody dog, he is driving me mad. We went and did a few laps. Unfortunately, it did have a bit of a misfire going on, so I didn't get as many clean laps as I would have liked to have got, but it was my only experience aboard a fully-fledged Indy car, which at the time I remember going, this is where I want to be and this is what I want to be doing. There's no doubt about it. Unfortunately, you know, it didn't progress down the path. But we did try to actually do a deal with the guy who owned that team for the next year or so. There was a fair bit of effort and work put into trying to raise the money, and a lot of ideas were put forth to try and put the budget together to actually do a deal.
What sort of bucks did you need to do that back then?
Well, the Indy Lights deal was, for a start, was around the sort of $800,000-$900,000 at the time, which now comparatively is quite cheap. Mm. But that was a lot of dough. And I think, you know, for the IndyCar side of things, you know, I think it was like a $4 million kind of deal back then in the late 90s to try and do something then.
Who was, you said about the people who were helping you and working with you, I presume Pete was part of that, but who else was involved behind the scenes in trying to facilitate that and get you into that opportunity?
Yeah, there's some of the local Kiwi guys here. A guy named Alan Stewart was actually supporting me as well at the time, trying to work through plans to make that happen. There was a guy named Gray Mathias as well, who's also helps out Fabian Coulthard a fair bit. He was involved. Obviously, my father. And then there were some guys on the US side as well that we'd met that was also trying to give us a helping hand. But, you know, it's just those challenges of motorsport and, you know, trying to do it. And the catch for me was, and I was in a pretty, you know, fortuitous position as I you know, as you said, it was 1997. I was still driving full-time for the Holden Racing Team at the time. So, you know, there was some great people back in Australia that were supportive of it as well. The team was supportive of it, you know, trying to make it happen. But, you know, the complexities of it all and and then, you know, not being able to, you know, fully get that deal together. I was very lucky that on the other side, on the flip side, supercars was going pretty good, and the growth of the sport was good, and there was opportunities on the table to, you know, cement myself and that side of it. Now, there's no real regrets because I gave it a shot. Maybe we could have done things different, better, who knows, but, you know, it got to a point where I had to make a decision. Do I go and become a paid driver in Australia and really build that, or continue to search for, you know, the millions to go and do the American dream?
Make money, spend money. I like making money. It's always a...
Yeah. I would have loved to have been able to not earn money for a little while, but get the chance to actually try and prove yourself in that class, in IndyCar. And, you know, I just look at what Scott Dixon's managed to achieve and, you know, what a brilliant career. And to be honest, you know, there's a little bit of envy because, you know, I would have loved to have had a chance. I mean, those cars were just sensational, and I love single seaters, and I loved the fact that IndyCar, you know, was such a complex series with short ovals, long ovals, road courses, permanent circuits, all that kind of stuff. It was just such a great championship. Obviously, it went through some tough times there for a while too.
Yeah, it was a great era, wasn't it? Because that's when the manufacturers were going nuts with Ford and Honda and Toyota and Lola and Reinhardt and big ticket sponsors and Mercedes-Benz, obviously, through Ilmor. So, yeah, big money. Big stuff. And of course, at the time, was during the split when CART didn't have the Indy 500, and it still was booming and strong. But we could do a whole nother IndyCar podcast about all that stuff. I want to talk a bit more about the international stuff because it's probably something, like I said before, that gets overlooked. So there was a little period there where there was a sniff and a potential of a British touring car seat with Williams and with Renault in the factory program there. So that's late 98. So the HRT stuff had ended. Before we get on to that, though, how did you find out that you're out of HRT in your gig? Did you get a phone call from Creno, or how did that all go down?
Yep. That's exactly what happened. And I was a bit naive, you know, but also naive about the whole thing. But I was also pretty distracted at the time, you know, trying to chase that whole American thing. And I wasn't playing the game and as anywhere near as well as I should have been. I didn't really have anyone representing me or anything like that. So you know, I was angry at the time that I'd been given the boot, or, you know, not didn't have a seat. But yeah, look back on it, it was pretty obvious and easy to understand with Brock leaving. You know, I suppose I just assumed that they were going to sit and wait for me to make my decision on what the hell I was doing, and I would be there alongside Lounsey. But, you know, obviously Scafie was looking for a drive and subsequently, you know, went on to do amazing things at HRT. But, you know, I was still, you know, had fingers and pies all over the place trying to work out my next move. And then I missed out on HRT or didn't have a drive there. And all of a sudden I was all pissed off because, you know, that was gone. But it was like, well, I sort of created the situation for myself. But yeah, Creno ran and gave me a call. And then obviously from that point as well, offered an enduro drive for the following year.
So that following year, you did the endurance races with HRT with Mark Noski. But late in the year, you did the 2-litre Bathurst with 888 and the Vectra, which I want to touch on because it's a bit of an overlooked Bathurst assault from your career. But then this opportunity to test and potentially get in the frame with Renault, who I think Menu was leaving from memory to go to Ford for the following year off the top of my head. But there was a seat there, wasn't there?
Yeah.
How did that whole thing start? And it was on and it was off, and you're coming, you're not coming, it's on. Where did that all start and how did it all flow?
Well, actually, Graham Moore from Sydney, who spent a bit of time doing super touring, all sorts of other racing as well, from North Sydney there. He was the guy, because I got to know Graham through the years at Super Touring, and he also knew Peter Addison really well, and he was actually someone that actually really worked quite hard to help me get a shot there. And I think he also used Alan Jones because of his connections at Williams and knowledge there to get me a test over there. And And so that all sort of came together, and it was a real busy time because I was doing stuff in New Zealand. We're doing some Formula Holden single seater stuff. There was, again, testing I was doing in America with Tasman, with Steve Horn at the time as well around there. Scott Dixon and I were both flying backwards and forwards all over the place at the time. He was going off to do testing as well. And so it was a crazy end to 1998 with Enduros, with HRT, the Formula Holden stuff, Tasman kind of series stuff back in New Zealand, Tasman Indy Lights testing, and that was another opportunity, and then also this test with Renault, Williams Renault at Nagaro in France, which was in the middle of winter over there. And so it was just a crazy time, and I ended up getting shipped off over there. Jason Plato was the other driver, and he was there at the test, very helpful. But it was miserable, absolutely miserable. And I as far as weather and everything goes, it was freezing cold in Nagaro, and I remember getting there, and here's this racetrack, and trying to get some laps in this thing, and again, front wheel drive. Tire temp, all that kind of stuff, really, really tricky. And a car I'd never driven before, a track I'd never been before. And it was all just, I think I had a bit of jet lag, all sorts of bloody rubbish going on. But it was still an incredible experience. And we got through the test. And all I remember is about that track is, if we think Sydney Motorsport Park's got high tire dig, I reckon there was half a lap. You got half a lap on a brand new set of Michelins around Nagaro before they went off. It was just unbelievable. And I just couldn't, I don't think I could get my head around it. But the test was the test. I don't from memory believe it went overly well. I then jumped on a plane and flew back to England, and was basically going to meet Frank Williams to discuss an opportunity potentially with the race team. And I remember going out to Williams in Oxford, and he was obviously a very busy man, Frank Williams, and I was actually sitting there at Williams HQ for quite a long time waiting for him to turn up, and eventually ended up in his office, and the meeting was reasonably short and quick. And the thing I remember most about sitting there being talked to by Frank was, at the end of it all, he said, so how much would you expect to be getting paid by us if you were given the drive? I was like, that is out of left field. That is so out of left field. I did not expect to be asked what I should be getting paid if he was going to employ me to drive his racing car for the 1999 British Touring Car Championship. I can't even remember what I said. I mean, anyway, I didn't get a second interview, so it must have been the wrong answer. I couldn't even tell you what it was. I think I said something along the lines of maybe what I was getting paid in Australia or something like that. I don't know. Maybe I undersold myself so much he thought, no, there's no way we're hiring this bloke. I don't know. But that was an experience. That was 98, yeah, full on.
So the Renault test in 98 wasn't your only 2-litre expedition that year. And everyone forgets that you drove at Bathurst for 888 in a Holden, but it was in a 2-litre Vectra, and in the race that always overlooked in history because everyone remembers the V8 race.
Yeah, it was only half the cylinders in the engine. That's right. That all came about being part of the Holden fold, and John Stevenson, motorsport manager at the time, kindly, I think, shoved me and Russell into that seat, and it was amazing. It was great fun. We had so much fun in that car, and they were pacey around Mount Panorama, and it all went pretty well, and ended up being provisional pole on Friday afternoon in the car as well, and before getting absolutely stomped by Rickard Rydell the next day in the top 10 shootout. But it was good fun, and Russ unfortunately got caught out on someone else who had dumped a whole bunch of oil at just going into Skyline and arrived there with unsighted oil all over the track and ended up buddy punching the thing in the fence, unfortunately.
I think it was a write-off, that car, after that, because it was a pretty big hit with he and...
Well, I think it was also the end of the era for that car. I think I remember Roland saying about how, you know, the amount of money that had been invested, BTC was a bit out of control at that stage with the manufacturers and how much money those cars were costing to build. And I'm pretty sure it was his sort of last run. Not that he wanted it written off, but I think they had new cars for 99.
Well, they definitely needed a new one to replace that one because it was about a foot shorter than when it arrived at Mount Panorama in 98. But you did a bit of other stuff along the way. When we stop and think about it, you have driven a lot of different cars and had a crack at a lot of different stuff. And one of the ones that is really forgotten, but you did it here in our backyard, was when Murph went NASCAR racing and spent all night dropping Days of Thunder lines on the radio to his crew. How did you get roped into doing a NASCAR race or two?
Oh, my goodness. Scott Williams, the great man, who was involved with our great mate Kevin Swanson putting that whole deal together I can't remember how I got introduced to all those guys and bits and pieces, but I think Scott might have actually just rung me out of the blue, got my number and just offered it up because, you know, it was 98, wasn't it?
Yeah,
and,
I think so, yeah.
And again, I was sort of in the middle of things and not really sure what was going on, sort of only part-time, obviously, with the endurance side of things with HRT and tripping around all over the world trying to put other deals together. And so, you know, I think I just got a bit of a phone call out of the blue and how about you come and give this a crack? And I was like, yeah, that's left field stuff. But it was intriguing because, you know, the Thunderdome was a pretty big thing back in the day. And you know, it was getting decent coverage as far as recognition for what was going on out there, the Oz cars and the NASCARs. And it was pretty full on. And so it was like, oh, you know, why not jump in and have a crack? How hard can it be? Well, stupid thing to say. It was very hard.
And you learned.
I learned, unfortunately, in the non-cost-effective way. Yes.
Oh, had you been it?
Yeah.
Oh, I forgot that bit.
I binned it. You did not forget that, but you'll have photos of it somewhere of me smoking the thing, the old Monte Carlo up against the fence. My biggest claim to fame, though, was at the Adelaide International Raceway on the tiny little oval. I put Jim Richards in the fence.
Did you really, you naughty boy?
I know.
Deliberate?
It wasn't my proudest moment. It was not my proudest moment.
Deliberately?
No, of course not.
Oh, it's got to say.
Gentleman Greg.
So that's part one of our chat with Greg Murphy on the V8 Sleuth podcast powered by Timken. We covered so much ground in part one. The good news is that there is still so much ground left to cover in part two. And in that, we talk about a bunch of stuff. We talk about the Spider-Man Kmart Bathurst Commodore. We talk about the famous press conference that same year in 2004 on the Gold Coast, where he and Marcus Ambrose teed off in front of the pack of media, who I don't think got too many questions in that day either. The National Motor Racing Museum couch racer questions. We got so many of those questions from you, the fans. We launched those at Murph, and he also tackles the Motor Focus, top 10 showdown. Sign up, of course, to our V8 Sleuth website. We've got a newsletter that keeps you abreast of all of our new products and news on the site. So jump on the v8sleuth.com.au website and subscribe to that. Follow us on socials and all the cool things that we do. Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, you know where to find us. In the meantime, though, hope you've enjoyed this episode of the podcast. Part two of Greg Murphy's just on the other side of this, if you click down the line. In the meantime, that's the V8 Sleuth podcast powered by Timken. We'll see you in part two of Greg Murphy.